Good morning. You might ask the question, why is your second address on Calvin and Dutch Calvinism when Calvin himself never went to the Netherlands? Well, one of my sub-themes this morning is going to be this. In little ways, you can influence people that might cumulatively add up to be a powerful influence. What I mean to say is this, whether it's in your own children or whether it's in distant friends, just a word here, a word there, a line of a letter, a little email can impact people in amazing ways. I often say to people, try to speak a good word for the Lord today. And I want to show you how John Calvin, through a variety of ways, has impacted the entire Dutch Reformation without ever stepping foot on Dutch soil. John Calvin wrote to his colleague, Henry Bullinger, in 1560, "I am a Belgian too," that is, a Netherlander. Perhaps Calvin said this because he had ethnic affinities with the Netherlands. After all, his mother and wife were both born in the Low Countries. Or some scholars speculate that Calvin might have felt a bit Netherlandish because of his own influence on the Dutch Reformed movement. Or some have said he was probably joking about his own bluntness, because he could be blunt in his personality, and that was a characteristic of the Dutch as well. Well, regardless of how Calvin meant it, Calvin did significantly influence the Dutch Reformation through his letters, his writings, his friendships, and of course, primarily through his training of men for the ministry and sending them back to be pastors in some area of the Netherlands. Now, rather than look at Calvin's influence in all of Dutch Calvinism, which would take us far too long to cover in 1 hour, I want to look with you at three things this morning. First, we're going to look at his influence on the Dutch Reformation until 1618. That is, we'll look at that section of history we looked at last night, but now we're going to look at it through Calvinistic lens. How did Calvin influence it? Second, we'll look briefly at his impact on the Great Synod of Dort. And then thirdly, we'll look at his impact on the Dutch further Reformation, as well as his influence on Dutch Calvinism in the 19th and 20th centuries. Most of our time we'll spend, however, on the actual Reformation proper, because that's what the conference is about here. Now, Dutch scholars have debated exactly how much Calvin really influenced the Dutch Reformation. Some have said, well, significantly, but not overwhelmingly. Others have said, very extensively indeed. No one would suggest that his influence has been negligible, and no one would say it's been all pervasive. One of the mistakes that 21st century North Americans make is to think of Calvin as head and shoulders above all the other reformers in Europe in his day, and everyone else around him as epigons, that is, as very secondary to his influence. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. Henry Bullinger in Switzerland was every bit as influential as John Calvin in his own day. In fact, there are 12,000 extant letters of Bullinger to all kinds of people all around Europe, more than Calvin and Luther's extant correspondence combined. Peter Martyr was every bit as influential as Calvin in his own day. And so the whole idea that we look at Calvin, we set him up as the ideal, and everyone else is good or bad, in accord with how much they agree with Calvin, even though I'm a real lover of Calvin, that's an untenable position to hold historically. The Reformation was full of reformations in different countries with different leaders, men who were greatly influential. But Calvin was bigger than life in the Netherlands, even though he didn't really ever come there. And I want to show you a variety of ways in which this is true. First of all, we have then his correspondence. And I've divided this into five quick categories. A lot of these names will be new to you, but just bear with me here a few minutes, and I think you'll see why I'm doing this. First of all, there's Menno Papias. He comes from Oosterzee in Friesland. He was formerly a priest, but was influenced by Calvin's writings, then became a Reformed minister in East Friesland and began to correspond with Calvin. Calvin influenced him, not only through his writings, but actually financially supported him out of his own pocket. Calvin also wrote to him about church life, about education, and about church discipline. Papias wrote a small volume as a support mechanism for people in the Netherlands against the Spanish tyranny and Inquisition, and then sent the manuscript to Calvin before he published it, and Calvin had it printed in Geneva and wrote a recommendatory preface. And so Calvin had a tremendous influence in the northern part of the Netherlands through this man named Papias. Calvin also corresponded with two brothers, Philip and Jan van Marnix, who were the first two Dutch students that came to the Geneva Seminary. Philip van Marnix studied with Calvin and his successor, Beza, and then became advisor to William of Orange, of whom we heard last night, leader of the Dutch revolt against Spain. Marnix called his mentor, Calvin, after Calvin's death, quote, the admirable prophet of God, John Calvin. So there were many examples of these Genevan Academy contacts that Calvin wrote to and influenced who resided somewhere in the lowlands. But secondly, Calvin also had a lot of correspondence with Dutch nobility, particularly the Dutch nobility that were in exile. Let me give you just a few examples of that as well. First, there is a gentleman by the name of Count Meldeno. He became a deacon in Geneva and was impacted by Calvin, and he was a Dutch nobleman in exile. There also was a man by the name of Duquesnoy from Rijssel. And in exile, he went to Lausanne, became a philosopher, and then a professor of philosophy. And Calvin regularly dialogued with him. And his theology greatly impacted this man. Calvin also wrote 54 extant letters to the nobleman in exile, Jacob of Burgundy, Lord in Brabant, and of Bredam in Zeeland. Calvin even dedicated a book to him and had a very strong friendship with him until eventually his views on predestination changed and he took the anti-Calvinist position. And that friendship broke down. Calvin also had a very good relationship with a man named Etienne de Lafond. He was a close friend, and Calvin corresponded with him at great length. And later on, Etienne called Calvin a God-fearing martyr of the gospel because he gave his whole life to it. And then thirdly, Calvin was greatly influenced by and had influence on Dutch publishers. And the most infamous one was Jean Crispin, who had been banished from Utrecht and came to Geneva in 1548 and became Calvin's publisher. And so later on, when he went back to the Netherlands, he also brought back that influence of Calvin to the publishing world. And then Calvin had a lot of correspondence with various Dutch clergymen. There was Jean de Saint-André, who had gone into exile to Geneva and became a preacher at the urging of Calvin, first in Geneva and later on in the very heart of the city. Then there was Jean Cavent, who after his exile became a deacon in Lausanne and received a letter of condolence from Calvin after the death of his wife and mother. There was Albert Hardenberg, who became a preacher in Bremen in 1547, who dialogued with Calvin at length about the Lord's Supper and what communion meant. And in fact, Calvin wrote a little booklet for him on the Lord's Supper that's now contained in Calvin's works. You see, all kinds of influential clergymen Calvin had involvement in their lives. There was a man by the name of Pierre Alexandre from Utrecht, who was formerly a chaplain. There are 11 letters extant that Calvin wrote to him. And he became a preacher in the Walloon Refugee Church in London and called Calvin his honored mentor. Gaspar van der Heijden, a very influential Dutch preacher later on, was one of Calvin's students. Jean Taffin, who we just translated one of his books, The Marks of the True Christian from Doornik, was a Walloon clergyman in Antwerp and chaplain to the House of Orange. He was also Calvin's student. Jean van der Moyen from Brussels studied with Calvin, later played a role in the Dutch Refugee Church in London. And of course, you heard last night about Guido de Bray, was also shaped by Calvin in Geneva. And then Pierre Labassulu was the president of two Walloon synods and insisted that all the ministers sign the Belgian Confession of Faith. Well, he too was in regular correspondence with Calvin. And then there were a number of Flemish emigrants that were in correspondence with Calvin as well. Jan Eitenhove had lots of contact with Calvin, as did a very well-known reformer at that time, Mikron. And both of them, together with a Polish reformer, Johannes Olasko, played a very important role in establishing the most important Dutch refugee church in England, the one in London. And lots of the Dutch went under persecution, went to London. In fact, there were 40 pastors that served that church at one point or another, and there were hundreds of members from the Netherlands. And these men were involved, all men who were molded by Calvin in leading this congregation. And from London, Eitenhove addressed his honored mentor Calvin as a very famous man and a highly esteemed brother to whom we are ever and wholly bound. Then there was Peter van Kruelen, who visited Geneva around 1558, sat under Calvin for a while, became a minister at Metz, then went to Heidelberg, and had influence also at the time the Heidelberg Catechism was written. Now, why do I mention all these things? Well, I want to just give you a feel that all of these people are influenced by Calvin in one way or another. Just a bit here and a bit there. You never know where one letter will go or what one phone call will do today or one email. I urge you, wherever you go, seek to leave the savor of Jesus Christ behind. Seek to speak a good word for the Lord. Seek to guide people according to the gifts God has given you. Calvin, just through his correspondence alone, profoundly impacted the entire nation of the Netherlands. And then there is, of course, the writings of Calvin. I won't belabor you here, but let me mention just a couple things quickly. There's a little book that Calvin wrote called Petit Tract, which was really just sort of a tract. Well, in those days, a 200-page book was often called a tract. But a tract that was circulated in the southern Netherlands, I mentioned it last night, as to how the persecuted French Reformed ought to conduct themselves in the midst of a Roman Catholic environment. And I indicated last night, you recall, how that Calvin recommended that they come right out in the open and declare where they stand, even if it means their death. Well, what I didn't tell you is that Calvin got into a pamphlet war on this issue over a period of time with a man by the name of Dirk Kornhert. And Dick Kornhert worked as a printer, a pamphleteer, and he was a member of the Family of Love, which was zealous for religious liberty. But Kornhert asserted that no one should risk his life for the sake of the church's external ceremonies. And so you shouldn't come out as a psalm singer, for example, or as praying in the vernacular, or as wearing clerical garb, or you shouldn't conduct sacraments, weddings, funerals above ground. You should do all this secretly and not show your colors. Well, they went back and forth, and several of Calvin's little booklets in this area were translated into Dutch, and they were in French, of course. And Calvin said that Kornhert's position was a reckless position, because Calvin believed that if you kept everything underground all the time, and you tried to avoid martyrdom at all costs, that eventually you would be influenced by the world, or you'd be influenced by Roman Catholicism, or you would no longer dare to be a Daniel and dare to stand alone, as we would say today. Now, this question is very relevant still today, isn't it? Are we standing up for biblical convictions in the context of perhaps of unbiblical churches, or in the context of a subtly persecuting world? Or are we perhaps so underground with our religion that we are capitulating in a host of external ways to unbiblical and worldly influences without ever uttering a word of protest? It takes a lot of wisdom to know, doesn't it? If a colleague at work swears at you, should you pull him aside? Should you expose him publicly? Should you just ignore it and go underground with it? There's all kinds of ways in which this question surfaces today. But what we need to learn is this, that Calvin influenced the Dutch Reformation this way by insisting that we must never lose our biblical convictions under a cloak of not wanting to offend someone. And we must not become like the apostate church and the apostate world. We must be willing to be persecuted before we are willing to compromise our essentials. Now, interestingly, many of Calvin's writings were smuggled into the Netherlands, and they were passed underground from home to home. His institutes, later on, had a primary influence in the Netherlands. They were republished many a time in Dutch, and people drank them in and were influenced by his theology. Although I must say this, Henry Bullinger's Decades, which we've just recently reprinted, were actually more influential than Calvin's Institutes, because the Dutch people loved their clarity and simplicity. And Henry Bullinger's Decades, which is 50 sermons covering all the doctrines of grace, all the doctrines of the Bible, of the Reformed faith, they actually were required reading for ministers in England for several generations and had a profound impact on the Puritan movement as well. Well, even more than by his writings and by his letters, Calvin influenced the Netherlands through the Genevan Academy. Dutch Reformed believers who were under persecution came by the dozens to Geneva, and many of them ended up studying at the academy, studying under Calvin. And beginning in 1544, Calvin and his academy would send seminary students to various persecuted churches in the Netherlands at the risk of their lives, and many of them died. Now, that is true also in France. In fact, it's even more true in France. But when the students graduated from Calvin's seminary and they shook hands with each other and said goodbye, they didn't just say goodbye. You know what they said to each other? We'll see you in glory soon. The average student that graduated from Calvin's Genevan Academy that went to France didn't live for more than 18 months. And in Holland, it wasn't that much better. Many of them suffered persecution and then martyrdom. James Tracy, a Dutch scholar today, notes that the able preaching, the well-defined doctrine, and the firm discipline administered by the Genevan graduates provided an organizational backbone to the fledgling underground churches under the cross in the Netherlands. And because of this, he goes on to say, unlike Anabaptism, Reformed preaching attracted significant numbers of merchant families and men of learning as well in the Netherlands. Now, the first preacher sent from Geneva to the Netherlands was the Dutchman Pierre Boulez. And he was actually Calvin's successor as leader of the French exile congregation in Strasbourg. Within 3 months after Boulez arrived at his new post, he was imprisoned and burned to death. A month later, out of love for him and in response to what had happened, Calvin wrote the Contra la Secta Fantastica des Libertines, which simply means against the fanatical sect of the Libertines. Two other important preachers were sent from Geneva, many more, but two very important ones, to the Netherlands. First, Guido de Bray, who you heard about last night. And secondly, Petrus Dathenus. Let me just say a word about Dathenus. Dathenus was from the southern Netherlands. While he was a teenager, he was already preaching in Kortrijk and surrounding villages. And he escaped to a congregation of exiles in London. From there, he went to Emden. In 1555, he went to Frankfurt. He served a Flemish exile church for a couple of years. Then he went to visit Calvin, became friends with Calvin, and studied under him in the late 1550s. And he came into a great debate when he went back to Emden to preach with a man named Caspar van der Heijden. De Bray and van der Heijden were debating about whether it was permissible for Lutheran ministers to baptize children from Reformed congregations. Interestingly, they agreed to settle their differences by appealing to Calvin. And Calvin came down on De Bray's side that as long as a minister was ordained, as long as he pronounced baptism in the name of the triune God, although it wasn't ideal, it was perfectly acceptable for a Lutheran minister to baptize children from a Reformed congregation, showing just a little bit of the ecumenical heart, I think, of John Calvin. Dathenus was also a big supporter of Calvin when it comes to the whole church-state question we saw last night. He fought avidly for Calvin's view that the church was in charge of church discipline and spiritual matters, and the state existed to help the church function and do its task without interfering with the church. And that was a tremendous influence. Dathenus' influence in the Netherlands won the day, eventually. It took a while in this particular area, but he was at least a good force to move it in that direction. Now, the other important thing you need to know about Dathanus is that Dathanus took the church order of Geneva, Calvin's organizational structure, borrowed a little bit from Alasco, from the Polish, and from Bullinger, and from Peter Martyr, brought it together, and what we still have today in our churches, the Dutch liturgy, we really owe to Dathanus. They're actually translated documents from late 1560s from Dathanus. So we have in our liturgy today in our churches, the Heritage Reformed churches, mostly Calvin's liturgy, but just through the Dutch tweaking of Dathanus. So Calvin, through all these men, you can understand, had a profound impact on the Dutch Reformation. Then there is, you notice fourthly on the outline, the Dutch fugitives. That is, particular centers and churches that developed that were Dutch-speaking or French-speaking from the exiles. Calvin also impacted them as well. I'll just mention two of them very briefly to you. First, the London church. The London church. Johannes Alasco from Poland, who was himself very influenced by Calvin's theology and advice and became a leading church order expert. And Jan Eitenhoven, as I mentioned moments ago, helped establish this congregation. Now, this congregation often wrote letters to Calvin asking for advice on different things, church order, church discipline, other issues. In 1552, Calvin writes an interesting letter to this church asking the leaders to be more moderate in exercising censure when dealing with customs and ceremonies that were not of major importance. Now, historians have found this letter to be fascinating because, you see, rumor has it that Calvin was always so tough, and you look at his Geneva consistory minutes and, you know, they did deal with people quite strongly at times, and there was a lot of discipline going on in Geneva. But interestingly, Calvin was, in certain times and places, telling people, no, don't discipline too much now. Be a little more moderate in some of these different customs. Don't try to force new customs on people in areas where they're not used to it. As long as it's not a biblical, solid biblical principle, show some flexibility. And Calvin showed that also in Geneva himself, in his own worship. There were many things he wanted to do differently that the town council didn't appreciate. But he said, well, they're not essentials. So even though he had a different position, he bowed under it. And that too, I think, is a lesson for us. Sometimes people want to be so thoroughly Calvinistic, and they come into churches and they destroy the churches without working with the customs that are there. Actually, that would be against Calvin's position. You work from within and you work slowly. You work from biblical principles and you realize that this church is not perfect here on earth. You need to work with things. If the church was perfect, they wouldn't need the ministers very much, would they? Everything would be well already. I mean, ministers still have to preach, but there are no perfect churches on earth. So we're always working with the imperfect. And that shouldn't discourage us. That should encourage us because we're working with the imperfect, knowing that one day Jesus Christ will make everything perfect in the New Jerusalem above. Well, Calvin also had an influence on the Emden Church, particularly there through his books. Emden and Antwerp became the significant printing centers of Reformed publications. And this congregation of Dutch refugees took an active role. There they printed, translated, widely dispersed a number of Calvin's books. And I think while we're on this subject, we need to emphasize that the Reformers really believed that books were, next to preaching, the most important means of that day to influence the world for truth and for God. Martin Luther, you know, said, I take the ink pot and I throw it at the devil. He meant to say, when I write, what I'm doing is I'm attacking the very powers of evil. And the Reformers really believed what my father often told me when I was a boy. Don't ever think that just going to church twice a Sunday, spending 3 hours a week in church, that you'll get a fully good grasp of the Reformed faith. You need to buttress it during the week by reading the Reformers themselves. So if you think of this day and age, the printing press really isn't that old. Books were incredibly expensive. To buy a book was like buying a half dozen books was like buying a car today. It was a huge investment. But people laid out money for these books, and they pored over them and read them and imbibed them and reread them and re-reread them, and they had these truths saturate their minds and souls, and people that did that became leaders in the churches and became influential. You know, I wonder how many of you have gone your whole life and you've never read Calvin's Institutes, the most foundational book of the Reformed faith. There's lots of people in America today, and they say, I'm Reformed, I'm Calvinistic, and they've never read the basic Reformed textbook, Calvin's Institutes. I'm not saying you have to read every word of it. A few sections maybe you can skip over because there were polemical issues of that day. But most of it's very readable. Don't let Calvin be so daunting to you. In fact, if I can just mention this, we recently have published just a simple book to help get you, actually two simple books to help get you into Calvin. One is called The Soul of Life, The Piety of John Calvin. We've taken little snippets of his writings, simplified them just a bit, and let you read about Calvin's life and then about his basic writings of godliness. And this is an introductory book so that you don't end here, but go from here onto his Institutes and his commentaries, and you'll be amazed at what you'll learn. Calvin was a tremendous writer, and he reads really well still today. And then we also put out this book, 365 Days with Calvin, where we did the same thing. We took his commentaries and his sermons, little chunks of it, then had a paragraph of application, which we drafted ourselves, to apply what Calvin wrote, and we just took out a few difficult words, but it's very vintage Calvin, shortened a few sentences, get you into Calvin, you see, so that you can move from there to his Institutes and his commentaries. Read Calvin. I can't recommend it too highly to you. Now, fifthly, Calvin also had some indirect influence on the Dutch rebellion. I don't need to say much about this since we covered so much of this last night, but let me say this, that Calvin had this view that you were to obey your sovereign as long as that sovereign did not directly contradict the Word of God. And if he was an absolute tyrant that ran roughshod over you, he was really a sovereign more than of the devil than of the Lord. And in such cases, even though Calvin was very reluctant to agree to this, in such cases there may come a time where you, as a common person, may collaborate with other populace in order to overthrow such an ungodly government, called the right of resistance against tyrannical rulers by lower levels of government or by the populace. But Calvin was very, very careful to ever agree to this very readily. His successor in Geneva, who was very influenced by Calvin, Theodore Beza, wrote about this question in a book that was published in Dutch called, Concerning the Right of the Government Over Its Subjects, 1574. That was 10 years after Calvin died. But you see, that was right in the power struggle with William of Orange and Philip and so on. And in this book, Beza implicitly, through Calvin, is giving encouragement to the resistance movement because Philip has been such a tyrannical governor. And so Calvin has influence here as well. And then there is this tremendous background influence of Calvin in Dutch polity from 1571 to 1617, after Calvin has died. When the Dutch churches begin to meet secretly in various classis meetings and synod meetings, the church order that they're establishing is very much along the lines of Calvin. The Dutch churches are being guided by Calvin after Calvin is dead. And so the whole idea that was established in the Dutch churches, that no church could lord itself over another church, no minister over another minister, and for that matter, no minister over an elder or deacon, it all comes from Calvin. And I find that very interesting. You see, when you write books or when you influence people, God can use you long after you're dead. That's one thing that's, I write books, quite frankly, first and foremost because I feel closest to God when I write. I've got the writer's bug. Just like a runner gets a runner's high, I get the writer's high. I get ideas. I cannot not write. I feel restless if I didn't write for a week. But I also write books because this life is short. Sermons are great, and people hopefully will listen to them for years to come. But books have a longer shelf life than the sermon. And generations to come might pick up a book. There might be someone, if the Lord tarries, 100 years from now, that might pick up a book that I've written and might be blessed and be converted under it. That's an exciting thought to me. And that's what motivated the reformers too. They weren't just thinking of the temporary day. They were very much men of their day, but they were thinking of future generations. And so here's just one area among many where Calvin's writings were influential. And this in the Netherlands, decades after he had passed away. Now, Calvin also influenced the Synod of Dort implicitly. No real direct influence, but of course, his whole doctrinal system of soteriology is laying behind the Dortian fathers. And when the Arminians, therefore, came forward and said, election based on foreseen faith, universal merits of Christ, free will of man due to only partial depravity, resistibility of grace, and the possibility of a lapse from grace. And Dort responded with the 5 points of Calvinism: unconditional election, limited atonement, total depravity, irresistible grace, perseverance of the saints. This is all greatly influenced by Calvin. Basically what Dort said are 5 things. And listen how carefully these are crafted after Calvin's theology. Unconditional election and faith are sovereign gifts of God. While the death, that's head one of the canons. Head two, while the death of Christ is abundantly sufficient to expiate the sins of the whole world, its saving efficacy is limited to the elect. And then the canons have head 3-4 as one head. It's very confusing. The first time you look at it, you say, what? How can you have a chapter that's chapter 3-4? And what chapter 3-4 says is this: all are so totally depraved and corrupted by sin that they cannot effect any part of their salvation. But God, in sovereign grace, irresistibly calls and regenerates the elect to newness of life. So they bring total depravity and irresistible grace into one chapter together. Now why? Well, for this reason, you see, the Arminians were saying, here's 5 separate points we disagree with. One of the points we disagree with is total depravity. Oh, those Calvinists, you can't believe them. They just think man can never do anything good. There's no hope. They make everything hopeless. They just believe in total depravity. What kind of a religion is that? Does that attract you? But Calvin had said, you must never consider total depravity apart from irresistible grace. Because man is a sinner of greatest extremity, but God is a God of salvation of greatest certainty. And so irresistible grace must always be spoken in the same breath as you speak total depravity. You may never separate the two. Salvation is impossible with man, but it's sure with God. We're totally depraved, but God is a God of miracles. He works salvation. And so what they said was, look, you Arminians, we're not going to fall in your trap and let you move us to discuss total depravity all by itself on an island. Actually, all five of these points stand or fall together in the Scriptures. But certainly point three and four belong together, so we're not even going to give you the satisfaction of discussing these things separately. We're putting them in one chapter, chapter 3, 4. And then chapter 5, those thus saved, God graciously preserves so that they will persevere to the end. Though they may be troubled by many infirmities as they seek to make their calling and election sure. Now I like to summarize the canons this way. And I think this shows Calvin's influence as well. Because Calvin was a theologian of sovereign grace. Sovereign grace conceived. That's your unconditional election. Sovereign grace merited. That's your limited atonement. Sovereign grace needed and applied. 3-4 brought together. Needed, total depravity. Applied, irresistible grace. And sovereign grace preserved. That's what our Reformed Dutch heritage is all about. Sovereign grace conceived, sovereign grace merited, sovereign grace needed and applied, and sovereign grace preserved. Now, were there any differences between Dort and Calvin at all? Very, very few. The only one that I can pinpoint, and it's just a shade of emphasis, is that I think that Calvin advocated a bit more of an active role for God in reprobation than Dort did. Dort took a little bit more of the, what later became called, I won't go into that now, but later became called the infralapsarian view, a little bit more of a laid back role of God in reprobation, that God passed over and elected. Whereas Calvin was emphasizing more that God actually decrees reprobation. The sinner earns it with his lifestyle. It's completely his fault. But God was more active in reprobation than the Synod of Dort advocated. Well, the end result, you see, is that Calvin's stamp, his fingerprints, are all over the Synod of Dort. Now, let me conclude then by looking just briefly with you at Calvin's influence on the Dutch Second Reformation. Don't need to say much here because that's our whole next talk. But I just want to say this to you, that Calvin's influence on the Dutch Second Reformation, or we call it the Dutch Further Reformation, that's probably the preferred term today, is not as pervasive as some people think. Because the Dutch Further Reformation divines, they gleaned from Bullinger and Martyr and all these men. But it was an important part of the whole collective heritage passed down. And so all of the Dutch Further Reformation divines had read Calvin's Institutes, they'd read Bullinger, they'd read Peter Martyr's systematic theology, and they quote these in their writings freely. But it's not that Calvin dominates more than the others. But he does impact it in a substantial way. And then finally, Calvin's influence from the 19th century until today. What happens, you see, when the Dutch Further Reformation dies out? Usually, most scholars say, with the death of Alexander Cymry in 1784, so near the end of the 18th century, it dies out. The Enlightenment, other liberal influences take over. For a period of time, in the beginning of the 1800s, no printer was printing Calvin. Calvin was actually despised for a while. Now, partway through the 19th century, the Groninger School, was born, 1830. And the Groninger School was a theological movement that emphasized the personal life of Christ and emotional feeling and the cultural development of Dutch people. The Groninger School wanted to go back to Wessel Gansfort and Thomas A. Kempis and Jan van Weisbroek, those men we heard about that were pre-reformers last night. And they wanted to despise the Reformation, and particularly Calvin. And so they spoke out against Calvin and said that only the little people, that was their Dutch word, the little people, meaning the common man who wasn't very educated, the nobodies, it was very degrading, would ever adhere to such a theology as John Calvin taught. Now, later on in that century, you've heard of Abraham Kuyper, I'm sure. Kuyper comes along, gets influenced by some of those common people, those little people, experiences a personal conversion along the lines that these little people who emphasize experiential grace with God were advocating. And Kuyper says to the Groninger school, you have made a caricature of Calvinism. Actually, Calvin and Calvinism are the most pure biblical presentation of Christianity that has ever graced the earth. Well, that creates tremendous reaction. And for a good long time in the second half of the 19th century, the Netherlands is divided again over Calvinism. Many writers taking a very anti-Calvinistic stand and many others taking a very pro-Calvinistic stand. Eventually, the church gives way to theological modernism. The state reformed church becomes very corrupt and liberal, and the hierarchical organizational structures become liberal as well. And there are really no solid conservative Calvinists hardly left as preachers or left in the ranks of the organizational structure of the Reformed Church. So it's very sad. Along comes a man by the name of Hendrik de Cock. Hendrik de Cock. In the 19th century, he has a spiritual conversion, a crisis point, as a minister in his third church in Ulrum. He studies Calvin's Institutes, and he gets converted by it. And he's in the state church, and he begins to sound the bells of alarm that the church has gone to the dogs, so to speak. And he then begins to pray earnestly and preach earnestly that God would revive the church and make it truly Calvinistic. Well, his modernistic colleagues despise what he's doing. Eventually, they throw him out the back door. They depose him from the ministry. And in 1834, his congregation officially secedes from the Dutch state church. And that, in turn, leads these pockets of common people, these little people, who feel the same way, and then through de Cock's influence, a few other ministers, to establish little churches in different places. And because there weren't enough ministers that felt like the common people, they often had what they called exhorters, ruling elders that would get up and preach a word, or they had reading sermons, they'd read the sermons of the old fathers. And then eventually, the movement picked up steam, particularly when Kuyper came along a couple generations later, and there began to be more preachers to serve these congregations. Now, when Kuyper came along, Kuyper's dates, by the way, are 1837 to 1920. He was a formidable force in the Netherlands for the restoration of Calvinism and for what is now called Neo-Calvinism, N-E-O Calvinism, so that is something like Calvinism. Well, Kuyper did the work of 10 men. He was a preacher. He was the leader of the Doliansi in 1886. That's the movement he founded that would eventually bring two groups of people together to form what over here is known as the Christian Reformed Church. He was the founder of a daily newspaper. He wrote for it every day. He was the founder of the Anti-Revolutionary Party, the ARP, the political party in the Netherlands. He was the founder of the Free University of Amsterdam, which is still in existence today, but shot through with liberalism, unfortunately. And he even became the prime minister of the Netherlands for 5 years, 1901 to 1905. And Kuyper tried to do two things. He tried to say, on the one hand, let's keep this personal, reformed, experiential Calvinism alive. On the other hand, let's also emphasize what Calvin said about the Reformed truth going to every sphere of life. And Kuyper developed that further, and he developed different spheres of sovereignty. The state was one, the church was another, education is another, the family is another, and so on. And God has his principles for all these different spheres. Well, that sounds well and good, and it is to a certain point, but Kuyper made one mistake that Calvin would not have agreed to, and that is that all these spheres have their own rights and their own laws and their own principles, so that no sphere may usurp authority over another. The problem with that, you see, is that puts preaching and church at the same level as family or state or education. And so what happened in, not Kuyper himself so much, but especially in his followers, is that they began to accent the cultural things more than the religious things. So they wanted a Christian everything. Christian social movement, a Christian way of looking at the sciences. And that's all well and good. But the problem is that by the 1950s, the focus is all on the social things. And the experience of the soul has been forgotten. And there's two streams that develop out of the Christian Reformed Church. One does keep more of an experiential emphasis. The other doesn't. And today, the one that doesn't has gained the preeminency. And so the problem today is that very few people in this tradition are reading Calvin anymore. Very few are reading Kuyper's devotional books. And very few are actually reading Kuyper at all. And now, they're Christianizing everything. And the problem is that often what happens when you Christianize everything is that you get de-Christianized and you become more like the world. And that's what's happening in neo-Calvinism, sadly, today. And so you get examples like this of a minister in the Netherlands in 1984 describing a Calvinist. This is a man who's in the Reformed Church. He's supposed to be Calvinist himself. He says, what's a Calvinist? A Calvinist is someone without God who possesses a cold, severe, rigid moralism. A man who, just like Calvin, found every pleasure suspect, wanting to suppress every enjoyment in life. This just boggles your mind. Historically, where has this man been? And you see, this is the reason, well, one of the main reasons why I actually wrote this book, this new book, with Sinclair Ferguson and Michael Haken and others, called Living for the Glory of God, An Introduction to Calvinism. I want to show exactly the opposite in that book, and I hope I do. I show in that book that Calvinism is warm, and it's vibrant, and it's experiential, and it's outreaching. And it aims to impact every area of life. But we must never have preaching in the church just be another area. This must be the center of our lives. The pulpit must be the center. And the pulpit must guide us in every area of life. The Word of God must be absolutely foundational. So my goal is to show historically that we need to restore what Calvinism originally was, where it addresses every area of life and it's got things to say about every area of life, which is well and good and wonderful on biblical principles. But the queen of the sciences is still theology. And the center of life is still the church and the pulpit and the Word of God. So however you work that out, with the different spheres of sovereignty, the church, the Word of God must stay in the center and have predominance. Just like in the old medieval universities. They had the department, various liberal arts, buildings all around, but the center building, even architecturally on the campus, was the building of theology, showing that that's the hub. And all the spokes that lead out to different areas of life have to be connected to that hub. Well, in conclusion then, Bob Godfrey, for whom, by the way, I'm indebted more than any other writer, Bob Godfrey says this: Calvinism has penetrated and influenced the Netherlands fully as much as any other country in the world, if not more. The Netherlands has been a center of Calvinist living, thinking, and renewal, and Dutch Calvinists have made many contributions to the Reformed community throughout the world. So what the Dutch people need today in the Netherlands and what we need here today in America is to return to Calvin, to be influenced by him, to open up ourselves to his biblical theology, to read it, to be imbibed by it, to be absorbed by it, and then to spread it in the 21st century generations. And the church will be the far the better for it. Let's pray. Great God of heaven, please bless this address and teach us what it means to be truly biblically reformed and Calvinistic, and not to be embarrassed by it or to shy away from it, but help us to speak it out openly, boldly, compassionately, clearly, winsomely in our present generation. We pray in Jesus' name.